From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. The Soviet magazine Ogonek was the first and perhaps most important publication to give voice to glasnost. On today's Fresh Air, we talk about losing some of the recently won press freedoms with the editor of Ogonek, Vitaly Karotich. Also today, we talk with Latina writer Sandra Cisneros about giving voice to people who aren't usually heard from in the mainstream American press, the people of the big city barrio. And TV critic David Bianculli previews two new TV series. One comes from the future, the other from the distant past. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
Hours News.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The Air Force announced today that it has selected a team led by Lockheed to build its new ATF fighter. NPR's Brian Naylor reports.
The Advanced Tactical Fighter, ATF, is the Air Force's new top-of-the-line fighter. It's expected to cost some $100 million apiece, and the Air Force hopes to build 650 of them. Air Force Secretary Donald Rice, in announcing the contract will go to the team of Lockheed, Boeing, and General Dynamics, said the plane will be a formidable force.
The ATF will balance stealth, supercruise, and advanced avionics in a highly maneuverable fighter that will ensure that our pilots get first look and first kill.
Critics say the plane was designed to counter a no longer existent Soviet threat and say the money would be better spent upgrading current fighters. Today's announcement was bad news for Northrop and McDonnell Douglas, the two other companies bidding for the project. This is Brian Naylor in Washington.
The House Judiciary Committee has approved the so-called Brady Bill, establishing a 7-day waiting period for handgun purchases. The panel approved the measure after rejecting an alternative proposal that would have required prospective buyers to undergo point-of-sale checks of computerized criminal records. That amendment is expected to be debated again when the full House takes up the issue in 2 weeks. The Brady Bill's chances for passage improved last month when former President Reagan gave it his endorsement. Since then, President Bush has indicated that he might support the measure if Congress passes key elements of his crime bill. In a unanimous decision today, the Supreme Court gave the green light to organized labor to conduct a major drive to organize some 3 million hospital workers across the country. NPR's Nina Totenberg reports.
In 1989, the National Labor Relations Board, for the first time in its history, adopted an industry-wide rule that would automatically recognize 8 union bargaining units for workers who elect to be represented by unions at any of the nation's 4,000 private acute care hospitals. The American Hospital Association challenged the new rule in court, but today the Supreme Court unanimously upheld the rule, and organized labor said immediately that it would begin a drive to form unions at hospitals across the country. Currently, only 400,000 of the nation's 3.4 million acute care hospital employees are unionized. Today's ruling makes unionization much easier. It allows workers to form bargaining units under 8 separate categories: nurses, physicians, other professionals, technical employees, clerical employees, janitors, guards, and other non-professional employees. I'm Nina Totenberg in Washington.
Stock prices were up slightly today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained almost 3 points to close at 2930.45. Advances edged declines in active trading. This is NPR News. The FBI says it has arrested a man suspected of taking part in the 1976 car bomb murder of a former Chilean ambassador. Former Ambassador Orlando Letelier was living in exile in Washington, D.C. when he and an associate were killed by a bomb planted in their car. An FBI spokesman said a Cuban national called Virgilio Paz Romero was arrested near Palm Beach, Florida, after the case was profiled on the television show America's Most Wanted. Federal authorities in South Florida credit that national TV show for leading them to the man believed responsible for the car bomb that killed Chile's former U.S. ambassador 15 years ago. Doug Phillips reports from Miami.
Orlando Letelier was living in exile when a car bomb killed him and aide Ronnie Moffitt in Washington, D.C. in 1976. Although indicted 13 years ago, Virgilio Paz Romero, charged with actually detonating the bomb, remained a fugitive. But the FBI says Paz Romero was arrested Tuesday morning heading to work at a West Palm Beach area landscaping business. Miami FBI Chief William Gavin credits the syndicated television program America's Most Wanted with helping to find the 39-year-old fugitive. The Letelier bombing was featured last week, and an anonymous tip led investigators to Paz Romero. He becomes the fourth person apprehended in connection with the bombing. Two Chilean military officials were charged, but never extradited to the U.S. For National Public Radio, I'm Doug Phillips in Miami.
American manufacturers saw another drop in orders during the month of March. The Commerce Department reported that orders for durable goods were down by 6.2%. Durable goods are expensive, longer-lasting products like aircraft, cars, and big appliances. In March, factory orders for those items dropped to their lowest levels in 3 years, with aircraft and defense contractors among the hardest hit. I'm Corey Flintoff. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The new openness in the Soviet Union is giving way to a new crackdown. Now the government is blaming its economic problems on labor strikes and political rebellion. Yesterday, the Kremlin unveiled a new anti-crisis plan that bans strikes for the rest of the year. One of the most important forums for lively debate in the period of perestroika has been the Soviet weekly Ogonyok. My guest, Vitaly Karotich, has been the editor since 1986. He transformed it from a magazine that offended nobody to a forum for independent journalism and outspoken opinion. Under Karotich's leadership, it became the first Soviet magazine that printed uncensored letters to the editor. A new anthology of articles from Ogonyok has just been published in America. It's called The New Soviet Journalism. When Vitaly Karotich took over Ogonyok, the magazine had a circulation of 250,000. Under his editorship, the magazine became a huge success, and the circulation grew to 4 million. Now Karotich is afraid the magazine might have to change because there's not as much interest in serious, hard-hitting journalism.
Now people start to be tired. And now we start to have more and more independent publications, censorship coming back, but independent publications still existing with small circulation. And now people tired. It's impossible to discuss the problems in economy when we simply have not food in our supermarkets. In this way, now our magazine still the most popular and still with the biggest circulation, but more and more people are interested in what you call yellow press. Now it's possible to collect people if I'll publish article, I don't know, was Gorbachev homosexual or something, or book about the first lady of our country on the level of investigation, you know what I mean. It'll be very popular, but I cannot do this kind of journalism. We're still existing on our previous level.
So it sounds like the Soviet press is really taking on some of the characteristics of the tabloid American press.
We start to have it. You see, it's always, in time of great depressions, it's always born. In time of America depression, you born main amount of your tabloids, you born musical, you born all your great artists like Fred Astaire. It was all from the depression year, when it was the saddest period in history. People tired from reality. They need fairy tales. And in my country, I think the same.
What are the new press restrictions that you're operating under now?
It's possible to see that press freedom must be part of general freedom. It's impossible to have free press in conditions as in our country when paper belongs to government, when printing facilities are all governmental, when you simply belong to government and government every day, each day, can cut you out from the printing facilities and you'll be nobody. Our magazine fight it for independence and start to be independent publication. But in this way, we reach independence, but we have not independent printing facilities. We have a lot of money, but printing machines still in governmental hands. It means that free press, it's more dream until now. We have press law, yes, but in country with strongly centralized economy, it's not so easy. But we're still fighting.
Are you ever punished by the Soviet government With restrictions on your paper or restrictions to access to your printing press or anything
like that? Of course.
We
started from this, and all the history of our magazine, it's Serum of Punishments. And even last year, when we started fight for our independence, what did government? Government simply raised price up on our magazine 2.5 times. What more? Only in Washington, it was told me that you have 860 subscribers on our magazine. This year, they received only 2 issues. We published 17, but the Soviet Union have forgotten to send here those magazines. In this way, by sabotage, by the restrictions, it's possible to stop interest to magazine, and I'm really troubled by those facts.
For just joining us, my guest is Vitaly Karotich, the editor of the Soviet weekly magazine Oganyok, and a collection of articles from Oganyok has just been translated and published in a new book called The New Soviet Journalism. You referred to the recent independence of your magazine. When you took over the magazine in 1986, what was its relationship then to the Soviet government?
It was very interesting. When I came to magazine, under my glass on my table, I saw big lists where all the names of member of Politburo, ruling group of the Communist Party, and heads of Soviet government, and near each name was written his birthday. And near each date was written color or black and white portrait it's necessary to publish to this great event. What's the level on which magazine was existing? Magazine was very popular. It was in all army libraries, in all hairdressers' offices, but people stopped to read it. Now it's forbidden to subscribe our magazine for military libraries. It's a lot of problems with it. But in the same time, individual subscription rising, and now is very high. First magazine in the Soviet Union. When I came there, it was dull, such an official magazine. It was my aim to make it more readable. I'll try to do it, and people start to read it. In 1988, American editors in World Press magazine, it was kind of pool. They announced me editor of the year. I was very happy.
So when you became independent, what did that entail?
What it did. You see, first we fighted for this. It was not so easy because our magazine, Fighting for Independence, it was very small comparing with Pravda, main Communist Party newspaper, Pravda. It has around 500 journalists only in staff. They have a lot of money, a lot of everything, but they have not profits. And government like to have profits from our magazine. Our profits were around 70 million a year. And government feed it from us. And then when we start to be independent, we are ready to pay taxes, but all money are ours. And that was first conflict. And fight for this independence was more than half a year. Then we win, and government start to cut our privileges, start to tell us that they have not paper for us. It was very, and is, very strong and long fight. They propose us, please do what you did before, and you'll be happy, and we will give you all privileges. We still want to be independent, and it's very principled fight.
Last August, there was a new press law that abolished censorship and established criminal responsibility for government officials who interfered with the work of journalists. And then after that, Gorbachev suggested suspending those new anti-censorship laws. What are the state of those laws now?
They cannot have free press. And I remember how Gorbachev shouted that he want to have free press. You see, But always depends on it. You must understand, when we are fighting for free market, Gorbachev always speaking about free socialist market. What it means, nobody knows. When we are fighting for free press, it's going about free press, but then Gorbachev or another leaders say that we must have free press, but free for, and then they start to tell for whom. Our leading rulers of our country, they still want to have free press, but free in the borders which they'll permit. And Gorbachev, really interesting politician, when he start to have so many truths around him, he start to afraid it. And he proposed to stop press law. It was not so easy, but he proposed to stop it. It was not voted, but I think it's still possible to do. Another thing, government still controlling all the resources of paper and all the printing facilities. In this way, it's possible to control everything. Our magazine is strong and we're still fighting for survival. But so-called small, little independent publications rise paper price 2 times and they'll die.
Have you seen a change in the way Gorbachev responds to criticism in the press?
Gorbachev always hated criticism in the press. He is a wise man, but when he reads something bad about himself, he starts to be crazy. It's interesting because many times when we had real conflicts with him, it were conflicts on the level of critic. When we criticize in the army, which he afraid, or when it's possible to criticize him personally. It were strange events in 87, I remember. Statistics gave us fact that the 60% of Soviet people support the idea of perestroika, 40% are against. After this, Gorbachev announced that 100% all the Soviet population supporting the perestroika. When we published different figures, 60-40, which were quite normal, we immediately received a call and we were asked to fire a journalist who published, who prepared this article. I was punished. It was for half a year for such a small, stupid detail. And if we criticize Gorbachev and somebody of leader stronger, especially when we criticize our defense minister or KGB head, it starts to be such dangerous that it's impossible to work. But you see, profession must have those situations, and we try to survive.
Did you fire the journalist who Gorbachev asked you to fire?
No. It was a very interesting fight. The name of this journalist was Birukov, and he was a member of my editorial board. I simply hit him.
You hit him?
I told him that he is fired, and I crossed him out from editorial board, and I put him back only in 2 years into editorial board, but I still keep him in my staff. I paid him the same salary, and he working because he was good. He is good journalist. He never signed articles by his name for a year. Then it became better.
Oh, so you hit him by little word tricks and things
yes,
like that.
Yes, yes, yes.
Let's take a short break and then we'll talk some more. If you're just joining us, my guest is Vitaly Karotich, the editor of the Soviet magazine Ogonyok, and a collection of articles from the magazine has just been translated and published in the new book, The New Soviet Journalism. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. Vitaly Karotich is my guest, the editor of the Soviet Union's most popular magazine, a magazine that's been known for its dissent since he took it over. The magazine is Ogonyok. Why did you become a crusader when you became the editor of Ogonyok? That hadn't been your reputation until that point.
You see, it's dangerous moment. Sometimes it's dreams in strong women's heads, men's heads. I was from the generation which always dreaming about freedom. In 1956, we received secret Khrushchev speech about Stalin crimes, and we were dreaming about this, about the democracy, freedom, but we never had chance. In 85-86, we received this chance, and Gorbachev was from the same generation. And we did what we can do. It was dangerous age I have now. It's the age of the last chances. I think after 50, you start to understand that it'll be one chance more to do something, and it'll be not so easy to do something more. It'll be last chance in my life. Once I asked Gorbachev, are you responsible for what are you doing? Do you understand that if your perestroika fail, Tens of millions, peoples whom you provoked, will be punished, will be arrested, maybe even executed. In what way you'll live, in what way you'll be happy? He interrupted me, and then he told, and you think I'll have one perestroika more? It's my last two. The responsibility of our generation wasn't this, but I think now we need more and more youngsters. Now we need new ideas, new brains, and one of Gorbachev's mistakes that he's still surrounded by people who are elder than he is. We need more youngsters. I always tell that government, it's not football team, but necessary to have young people there, too. I think it's very important moment. I did it because I always was dreaming about this, and I fulfilled my dream. Now I'm happy. I don't know what it'll be after, but we need new step, new people.
Are you afraid that there will be a big crackdown coming up soon and that you will be punished or perhaps even put in prison?
Yes, it'll be. I don't know what it'll be with me, but strong crackdown will be in few next months. I think our military-industrial complex is ready. I think they'll make attempts. I'm afraid even next days, May 1st, 2nd, 3rd, 4th, I don't know why, but in my country, they announced as free vacations for all the country. 4 days, angry, hungry country, people who have nothing to drink and nothing to eat. People will be in the streets, and it's possible to organize each kind of provocations. I'm afraid it. But what can I do? I'm happy. I'm happy for what I did. I'm happy for my magazine. I'm happy for people's support. I'm happy that I was elected the deputy of our parliament simply from the street. People named me. And from the first balloting, I received 84% from 12 candidates. People believe in me and in my magazine. I never was so happy. Of course, it's dangerous happiness, but beautiful.
What have you been covering in the magazine during these days of crisis?
Strong articles against the economical policy of ruling Communist Party. Strong articles with alternative ideas. Strong support to people with independent way of thinking. We trying to publish, to make very constructive magazine. Each month we announced Man of the Month. It's very interesting. We are paying our pulse. And we announced in January, Man of January was Shevardnadze, Man of February was Yeltsin, etc. We announced people who are really popular. And we tell to the government, don't invent new heroes. You have people's leaders. You must listen over them. Please support people. But government still want to make people happy in its own way. I'm afraid that it will be tragedy, at least.
What do you think of Boris Yeltsin, who's now president of the Russian Republic?
I think he's genius of bureaucracy. I think he's very interesting man. It's men like Reagan. It's the same type of leader. Men who really interesting bureaucrat and who never try to do everything himself. Gorbachev start to push away from him all people who are not 200% agree with him. And all those people start to concentrate around Yeltsin. Maybe Yeltsin is not so bright as Gorbachev, but his stuff is brilliant. And in this way, Yeltsin start to be a real leader because he's a serious and interesting man. I think Gorbachev was more popular and had more chances in the beginning. But now Yeltsin is popular, but it's necessary to understand that Yeltsin still Russian leader. He don't want to be the leader of all Soviet Union. He even not recognize Soviet Union as it now. He want to be leader of Russia, and he want to be equal leader with leaders of another republics. Gorbachev want to be head of everything. He want to be head of all structure, of all empire. In this way, they have quite different ideas on what Soviet Union must look like. I talked with Yeltsin and he told me I need 4 republics, Russia, Ukraine, Kazakhstan and Belarus, who'll unite, sign agreement, and then if others would like to add fine. If not, we'll survive without them. Gorbachev want to have all republics together now, and he forbid all the variations. I think it's dangerous because those people connected as Siam twins. They have the same stomach and two different heads. I think now they must support one another, but they still hating one another.
Do you think Gorbachev has much longer?
I think now military-industrial complex start to use him as human shield. I think now they try to have all power in their hands and have Gorbachev only as a man who is symbol of power. Now, today, those days, it'll be plenum of ruling Communist Party Central Committee. But then radical and right-wing all deputies want to have this session of Supreme Soviet where they propose to announce impeachment for Gorbachev. It's a dangerous moment for him, and if he'll go to Supreme Soviet, it's possible. Maybe he'll announce martial law himself. It's not so easy to imagine what it'll be. But in this way, now conflict came to climax. I think in the next 2-3 weeks, it'll be solution.
What kind of solution?
I'm afraid that it'll be martial law or kind of strong dictatorship. It's possible to imagine because now country dispersed. I cannot tell you that it'll be salvation, even worse. It can be step forward the civil war. But we cannot have civil war in our country. For civil war, it's necessary to have at least 2 strong ideas. For many civil wars, it's possible to have many smaller ideas. And I'm afraid that in Soviet Union, we'll have 5-6 civil wars in Middle Asia, in Caucasus, in Baltics, and a dangerous and bloody perspective. It's necessary to stop it, but I don't know yet in what way.
You're going back to the Soviet Union soon, right?
Yes.
Well, how soon?
26, April 26.
That's very soon. How do you feel about going back during a period of crisis when you're predicting that a dictatorship will be ruling in a couple of weeks?
I'm a man, and I understand as human being, I must stay here, especially because many institutions propose me this. As deputy, as editor-in-chief, I now must be there. It's a stupid situation, but to save my face as man, as Democrat, as journalist, I must be now with those who need me. If I'll be somebody else, but now I must do what I obliged to do until the last. If it'll be impossible to work, I think I'll go out and wait until it'll be possible to work once more. Now it's too dangerous, but we never have choice. It's necessary to live in such a way that you wake up in the morning and know that you are doing all you can. I think it's my journalist's happiness.
Well, I want to thank you very much for spending some time with us. Thank you.
Thank you for all. Thanks.
Vitaly Karotich is the editor of Oganyok, the popular Soviet weekly that has pushed the limits of Soviet press freedoms. A collection of articles from Oganyok has just been published in English. It's called The New Soviet Journalism. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer, in personal computing, providing the power to be your best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Sandra Cisneros is a Mexican-American writer and a feminist. She was the only daughter in a family of seven children. Coming up, we talk about growing up with six brothers to defend her and annoy her, and how that's affected her identity as a woman and a writer. Also this week, ABC is trying out two new series, My Life and Times and Dinosaurs. TV critic David Bianculli previews them both. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. UN military observers from 36 countries are now arriving in Kuwait City and in Baghdad. On Wednesday, a small contingent will establish the first UN posts along the Iraqi-Kuwaiti border. NPR's Michael Scholar has more.
Eventually, there will be over 1,400 UN observers and troops patrolling a demilitarized zone that extends 6 miles into Iraq and 3 miles into Kuwait. But to start with, just a handful of observers are heading to the border with their tents, according to General Gunter Grindel, who leads the UN force.
We will set up 3 posts, so this is our first presence in the demilitarized zone, and we will raise the UN flag there.
American troops along the border will not leave until all UN forces are in place, probably 2 or 3 weeks from now. There is still no word on what will happen to the nearly 20,000 refugees along the border. The UN team has no authority to protect them. But Iran has agreed to accept 1,900 refugees starting Thursday. This is Michael Scholar in Kuwait City.
A senior State Department spokesman says the U.S. opposes putting Saddam Hussein on trial for war crimes right now because setting up his trial in absentia could help him to stay in power. John Bolton, the Assistant Secretary of State for International Organizational Affairs, says the U.S. has no plans to bring the Iraqi leader to justice. Bolton says that if Saddam were convicted, all countries participating in the Geneva Conventions of 1949 would be forced to turn him over to authorities. This would end any possible deal that could give Saddam safe passage to another country in exchange for stepping down from power. A senior Israeli officer has been demoted and retired from the army after he was convicted of ordering soldiers to beat Palestinians. Linda Gradstein reports from Jerusalem.
Colonel Yehuda Meir is the highest-ranking army officer to be tried for crimes during the Palestinian uprising. In 1988, he ordered troops to break the arms and legs of Palestinians in 2 West Bank villages as a punishment for violence there. According to Israeli law, force can be used only to arrest Palestinians who resist, but it may not be used as a deterrent or as a punishment. Today, Meir was demoted to private and retired from active service in the Army. The prosecution had asked for a jail sentence, but the military court said ending Meir's Army career was enough of a punishment. Since the beginning of the Palestinian uprising in December 1987, more than 1,000 Palestinians have been killed, more than 700 by Israeli soldiers, and more than 300 by fellow Arabs who suspected them of cooperating with the Israeli authorities. For National Public Radio, this is Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem.
On Wall Street today, stocks closed slightly higher. The Dow rose nearly 3 points to close at 2930.45. Advances led declines in active trading. This is NPR. Scores of people are still thought to be trapped under rubble in Costa Rica and Panama after yesterday's deadly earthquake, which measured 7.4 on the Richter scale. There were at least 20 aftershocks, five of them serious. More than 70 people are known to have died, and scores of buildings were toppled. Thousands of people are homeless. Firefighters struggled with major blazes well into the night in the port city of Puerto Limon. President F.W. de Klerk of South Africa, on a visit to Great Britain, has rejected calls by the African National Congress for an interim government. Janet Berry reports from London.
The ANC has demanded the resignation of President de Klerk and his cabinet. They say a neutral interim government must come to power before negotiations for a new post-apartheid constitution can get underway. Rejecting the demands, President de Klerk called for the further lifting of sanctions against his country. He said he was not begging for handouts from the international community, but added that economic growth was necessary to ease the movement towards democracy. ANC Deputy President Nelson Mandela is due to arrive in London on Wednesday, when he will meet British Prime Minister John Major. The ANC today voiced its anger at plans for the British Foreign Secretary to visit South Africa in the next few months. They say it shows a disregard for the views and opinions of South Africa's black majority. For National Public Radio, I'm Janet Barry in London.
Clashes between Christians and Muslims in the north of Nigeria have left about 80 people dead and more than a dozen churches on fire. The military governor of the province has imposed a dusk-to-dawn curfew. Residents of Lagos, Nigeria's capital, say Christians are flooding to the city from the north, which is heavily populated by Muslims. The south is dominated by Christians. The deaths are the first since the reported outbreak of violence last week. The fighting apparently began over whether Muslims and Christians should use the same slaughterhouse. This is NPR News from Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Sandra Cisneros is a Mexican-American writer who grew up in the barrio of Chicago. The Iowa Writers Workshop was her ticket out. She writes about what she knows and never read anywhere else, the stories of Mexican-American women, their lovers, their families, their neighborhoods, their work, and their dreams. Each of the stories in her new book, Woman Hollering Creek, is written in a different voice and from a different perspective. She says she felt a responsibility to tell the stories of Latino women who are seldom represented in the mainstream press. Her first book of fiction, The House on Mango Street, was more autobiographical. It's just been reissued by Vintage. Cisneros grew up with a strong father and six brothers, no sisters. She says it was her mother who helped her find her own strength.
I have arrived at my life and my lifestyle mainly through the efforts of my mother, who you see had great aspirations in her life but realized them rather late. And so she was very fierce about making sure that I wasn't going to repeat her life. She was very fierce about making sure that I was going to study and work hard and have a way of supporting myself that was very important to her, that women be able to support themselves. And that's not how my girlfriends were raised, nor my cousins. They were not raised to think that you had to take care of yourself first. My mother assumed that I might marry and probably would, but she said, you never know what's going to happen to your husband. He might die, he might run away, something could happen. You just have to be able to take care of yourself, so make sure you do that you can. And so as a consequence, I wasn't very good in the kitchen, and she would, let me study. And I still don't know how to cook very well. And, you know, I would be standing over the rice and letting it burn because I was thinking. I just didn't have the skills it took to be in the kitchen. But that was fine. My mom allowed me to study, and as long as I was studying, it was okay that I wasn't helping her in the kitchen. I could help her later on doing something else.
Would you describe what the neighborhood you grew up in is like?
Well, I grew up in lots of neighborhoods. I like to tell people in the Southwest that I grew up in the border of black and white neighborhoods, because Chicago's very segregated, you see. So there's always that brown corridor between the black community and the white community, and we were a bit amphibious. You know, we kind of didn't get along with either, and we kind of could get along with both. And so I grew up in neighborhoods that were always being rehabbed, people getting shuttled and moved along on the outskirts of where universities were taking over and gentrifying neighborhoods, or neighborhoods that were changing and that we could afford to live in.
You write in, gee, I forget where you said this, that you hate to see the way barrios end up looking like Sesame Street. In the yeah. Mass media, and I wonder what you were thinking of when you said that.
Well, because, you know, barrios are only cute in the daytime. when you go slumming and say, oh, isn't this a great neighborhood? Look, we can go shopping here and have a whole meal for $3.95. But it's not cute if you are stuck there and can't get out and you have to go to work and at 5 o'clock in the morning and walk down to the bus stop at night and hope nobody bothers you, or come home from work evenings and you have to have your husband or your brother or someone pick you up at the bus stop and walk you half a block to your house to make sure that you're not molested. You know, it's not cute if you have no means of leaving. Only, as Eduardo Galeano, a friend of mine, said, only intellectuals think that poverty is attractive. But people who live in those neighborhoods, they don't want to live in those neighborhoods because you don't have city services, you're afraid to go out your door, there isn't enough sky, the schools are the worst schools in the city, and a lot of times your food stores are the worst, everything's the worst.
What was your way of defending yourself when you were a teenager?
I think the way that I defended myself was through books, because I had the ability to transform myself from my environment by reading. I could remove myself from the circumstances by reading and entering other worlds.
But carrying books when you're walking down the street isn't going to exactly warn people away from
I had
from
six brothers.
Okay, well that's a good start.
That was another way, too. But one thing that I always say, you know, I had six brothers, but who protected me from the six brothers?
Did they pick on you a lot? Did they see?
Oh,
did they
yeah.
See, yeah.
Uh-huh. I was, the sister, and so you know, boys have a very different ways of looking at the world than girls do. So, they just kind of harassed me and kidded around, even though they love me very much and take care of me. But they have a very different way of treating me than they do, perhaps other women.
I want to get back to the idea of if you were brought up differently than your brothers were, do you think that they were given certain freedoms that you weren't allowed? Were your parents very protective of you as the daughter?
Yes, especially my father. But I also have to say that I'm an only daughter, which in a Mexican family elevates me to a status of some type of princess, you see, and has nothing to do with financial advantages, being the princess. You're the father's favorite child, and Mexican princesses are treated in quite an extraordinary way. They're protected, they're restricted, to go out anywhere. Brother had to escort you at least to the bus stop and bring you back, much to the complaint and lament of the brothers, you see. So it was a little bit difficult. I'm my father's favorite, but because I was the only daughter, the brothers had to do a lot of things for me, and it was it handicapped me in some way because I was so dependent on having my six brothers rescue me in circumstances. I didn't learn how to drive until very, very late in my life. I was so used to having the brothers rescue me, so to speak.
I think it's fair to say you're a feminist now, yes?
Oh, fiercely.
Yes. So what was the transition between being the protected princess of the family and becoming a feminist?
Well, I think that, for a long time, I didn't question my father's restrictions or my brother's role. I thought that that's how it had to be. And it's very hard for women in my culture, or men, for that matter, to leave their father's home as a single person. You don't leave your parents' home until you're married,
yeah.
And sometimes not even then. But I found the route out by education. I told my father that I had to go away to school, you see. And by the time I was in graduate school, I was ready to go away. I could have gone away as an undergraduate had my father allowed me to live in the dorms. But my father is a very traditional man, and like many Mexican fathers, wouldn't allow me to live in the dorm, even though I went to school two buses and a couple train rides away in the city of Chicago. But by the time I was ready for graduate school, I'd figured out I better pick a school that was in another state or I'd never get out the door. And I've always used the education and the necessity to write as my key out, you see, even though it is very, very unusual to see a single woman living alone. And it's very unusual to see a woman like myself at 21 years of age living out of state. Also, when I graduated from my MFA, my father still assumed that I would come back home. And to this day, every time I go home, my father says, "Your room is here. When are you going to move back? Why don't you live here and write upstairs?" He still doesn't conceive that at 36 of years of age, I might not move back.
Right. Did you feel socially behind when you went to college, having been protected for
so
long.
Yes, I did. Yes, I did. But see, I only saw myself behind if I looked at myself with my American eyes. If I looked at myself with Mexican eyes, I would see how advanced I was.
Sure.
But it wasn't until I realized the clash of those two values and cultures that I could see myself in a new light. And so in a way, seeing myself through American eyes debilitated me and lessened me, you see.
My guest is Sandra Cisneros. Her new collection of stories is Woman Hollering Creek. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Mexican-American writer Sandra Cisneros is my guest. In your acknowledgments, you thank your mother who gave you the fierce language.
Yeah, my mother is from a working-class neighborhood in Chicago, you know, and so the English that she learned was what I call the tough, punch-you-in-the-nose English, the street English. And I think that voice, that English and that voice that I hear sometimes in my stories comes from my mom.
It's not a tongue you speak yourself?
I think that I'm a product of my education, and so I'm much more articulate than many people in the neighborhoods my mom was raised in, and I can't help but be a product of my education. But I can give voice to those voices that are, you know, my mother's voice, my community's voices. So I wish I was... I had that fierce voice. It comes up in the writing, if not, especially, perhaps not in my own physical voice.
Yeah, because you have a kind of small voice physically.
I have a very thin voice, but it's my disguise, you see.
For?
For the real me that comes out in these stories.
Is that how you feel?
I certainly feel it. I used to hate this voice because I thought that it pegged me as this passive, quiet little girl. And my size is small, you see. But now I see it as a wonderful shield. And I can get past a lot of guards if I play up that role. People say things in front of me that they wouldn't say in front of other people and ignore that I'm there as an observer and that I'm going to do something.
Is your voice the voice of a princess, you know, the family's princess?
Well, only other princesses recognize that. Like my friend Mary Helen Ponce said, when I knew you, met you, I knew you were a princess. I said, yes, we all recognize each other. So the whole theme of the Mexican princess, which has nothing to do with financial means, is what I'm going to pick up in my novel, the hijas de Iztaccíhuatl, the daughters of Iztaccíhuatl, you see.
So when you look back on it now, Was it finally an advantage or a disadvantage to be the princess of the family?
I was Cinderella, and that was my nickname as a child. My mother called me that. I was this girl that was living in a poor neighborhood, but I really didn't belong there. I thought very highly of myself, and my father made me believe in that high esteem. So I may have been living in a neighborhood that was run down and, you know, in a pumpkin shell, but I believed that it was only temporary, that it was just a spell. You see, and it would break.
Can I ask you to read like a short passage that gives us a sense of the voice that you found in fiction? Do you know what I mean? That other voice?
That the real me?
The fierce language voice.
Oh, well, this is from the silly character in the last story, Bien Pretty. She's part of the Chicana hipwazee, something that I'm part of, too. These Chicanas that are so Mexican, they make Mexicans look un-Mexican. We're trying so hard to be Mexican. We're more Mexican than the Mexicans. So I wanted to write about, make fun of that class of educated Chicana women. But it also is a character that I love very much, too. She may be silly, but she also is fierce. Maybe once or maybe never. Maybe each time someone asks, "Wanna dance?" at Club Fandango. All for a Saturday night at Hacienda Salas Party House on South Mission Road. Or Lerma's Night Spot on Zarzamora. Making eyes at Ricky's Poco Loco Club or El Taconazo Lounge. Or maybe, like in my case, in my garage making art. Amar es vivir, what it comes down to for that woman at Centeno's and for me. It was enough to keep us tuning in every day at 6:30. Another episode, another thrill. To relive that living when the universe ran through the blood like river water. Alive. Not the week spent writing grant proposals. Not the 40 hours standing behind a cash register, shoving cans of refried beans into plastic sacks. Hell no. This wasn't what we were put on the planet for. Not ever. Not Lola Beltrán sobbing, soy infeliz, into her four cervezas, but Daniela Romo singing, ya no. Es verdad que te adoro, pero más me adoro yo. I love you, honey, but I love me more. One way or another. Even if it's only the lyrics to a stupid pop hit. We're going to write the world and live. I mean, live our lives the way lives were meant to be lived. With the throat and wrist. With rage and desire and joy and grief and love till it hurts. But goddamn, girl, live.
You know, your whole voice changes when you start speaking in Spanish?
Yeah, it does. Yeah, I think that's a little frightening, too, to think about that. There's something schizophrenic about being Mexican/Mexican-American, you know, when you are straddling those cultures. And I think that, to me, all the Spanish that I've learned comes from one person in my life. That's my father. And so I really want to explore the relationship of daughters to fathers, the princesses, the relationship of Mexican men and how they love women and how they love daughters. That, to me, is intriguing.
So you think when you speak Spanish, you speak in a more, you know, in quotes, male kind of voice because it's your father's voice?
I think so, and it's also a male culture, and also there's a different way of looking at the world. It's a very a tender and affectionate language to me. So it has incredible connotations to it that the English does not.
Sandra Cisneros, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Sandra Cisneros has a new collection of short stories called Woman Hollering Creek. It's published by Random House. Vintage has just brought out a new edition of her first book of fiction, The House on Mango Street. This is Fresh Air. Noah Adams is with us. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Hi, Noah.
Hi, Terry. Tonight we're going to take some extra time to tell the story about a multiple vehicle collision back in December in southeastern Tennessee. Almost 100 cars and trucks were wrecked that morning in a very dense fog there. 12 people were killed and 50 were injured. We'll be talking with survivors and with rescue workers tomorrow in Knoxville, Tennessee. The National Transportation Safety Board opens hearings into the causes of fog-related collisions. In general, there have been bad accidents in California and one in Utah, and of course the one in Tennessee, the one we're going to hear about tonight.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. The official TV season has just ended, and it's only a month till the networks announce their schedules for next fall, which is why new series keep premiering so the networks can test them out. TV critic David Bianculli has some thoughts about two new ABC series. He's seen all 7 episodes of one of them and just a test reel of the other.
The series I've seen all of is My Life and Times, which premieres Wednesday. It's created by Ron Coslow, who did Beauty and the Beast, which I hated. So I didn't expect much from My Life and Times, especially since it sounded so gimmicky. Basically, My Life and Times takes the flashback idea from the Wonder Years and pushes it even further by giving the storyteller role to an octogenarian instead of a young adult. That way, he remembers not only his childhood, but his entire life. And if that weren't enough, My Life and Times ups the ante by placing its hero in the future, so that while he looks back, viewers can occasionally look ahead. Tom Irwin of the Steppenwolf Theater Company stars and delivers the same involved introduction at the start of each episode.
I wouldn't say I've seen it all, but I've seen a lot. I've seen the world change. I've seen myself change. I've watched footsteps on the moon and seen myself stumble. I've made a fortune. I've lost a fortune. I survived the 90s and braved the millennium. I've known fear and did my damnedest not to be afraid. I've loved and loss and live to love again. The one thing I know is life is an adventure. You've got to hold on and let it carry you away.
It turns out that Ben's introduction is actually a blueprint for the series' first 7 episodes. He makes a fortune and loses it, gets odd jobs and loses them, and rushes in vain to help his wife get through childbirth, only to nearly lose her and the baby to the Bay Area quake of 1989.
Wow. What a beginning. You arrive and the earth shakes. Huh? I wanted to be here. Someday I'll tell you why I wasn't.
That's not an idle threat either, because this guy spends the entire series telling stories to anybody who will listen. But other than that earthquake story, there's nothing really earth-shaking about My Life and Times. I have to admit, though, that it is intriguing, especially when we get a peek at such events as the celebration of the millennium and the economic collapse of 1998. But what's disappointing is that you can't tell the future from the past without a scorecard. There's no effort to spend money on any futuristic set design or wardrobe other than a tacky model of a bullet train. And while the poetic romance of My Life and Times is a lot more tolerable than in Beauty and the Beast, it's still a bit overdone. The best scenes are the ones in which the elderly storyteller bonds with his eager grandson, and the best trick is that the stories are presented out of sequence. Characters age, die, and reappear, and pop up in lots of different places and situations, kind of like Sam in Quantum Leap, or Billy Pilgrim in Slaughterhouse-Five. Even after watching 7 episodes, though, the best adjective I can muster is interesting. As for Dinosaurs, the ABC comedy that premieres Friday, it's still not ready to screen for critics, but I can't wait to see it, and I recommend you give it a try. It was the last project Jim Henson worked on before his death. It's a prehistoric sitcom from the dinosaurs' point of view, and the special effects look fabulous. It could be the show of the year, or could soon be extinct. I predict, however, that Dinosaurs will outlast My Life and Times. My Life and Times is set in the future, but Dinosaurs has a brighter one.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Post. Our reviews and interviews are produced by Naomi Person, Phyllis Myers, and Amy Sallet, with Joan Tuohy and Roberta Shurrock. Research assistance from Ellen Silva and Tracy Hildebrand. Fresh Air's theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and is performed by the Microscopic Septet. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-8-TALBOTS. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
You've probably seen him giving the big picture on Saturday Night Live. On the next edition of Fresh Air, we get the big picture from A. Whitney Brown. Also, Richard Marriott of the Clubfoot Orchestra talks with us about making new music for some very old silent films, films like Nosferatu and The Cabinet of Dr. Caligari. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.
remaining chemical and biological weapons capabilities. We'll have a report from NPR's Jim Zaroli coming up in a moment on All Things Considered right here on 91 FM. Forecast tonight, increasing cloudiness, a 40% chance of rain by morning with a low of 48 degrees, and the time is now a minute before 8.
Tomorrow on Radio Times, a muscle man and a chanteuse. At 10 o'clock, Sam Fussell takes us into the bizarre world of bodybuilding. And at 11, cabaret singer Karen Akers talks about her acting and singing career. I'm Marty Moscowane. Join me tomorrow between 10 and 12 here on 91 FM WHYY FM in Philadelphia.